Well, tonight I wanted to talk about anatta for beginners. Now, anatta is it's one of the things that the Buddha taught earliest in his career, and he returned to it often. And it has one of the shorter lists. There are lots of lists in Buddhism, and anatta is on one of the lists of the list of the three characteristics of conditioned existence: anatta, anicca, and dukkha. I'll save the translation for later. Anatta, impermanence, and unsatisfactoriness or suffering. So part of what I want to talk about tonight is how we translate anatta. And also talk about how the Buddha used the term in his teachings and look at how he thought about views in general. Partly because it's anatta has a bad reputation as being a really hard thing, and also partly I think that looking at the way that the Buddha used it in his teachings, I like the way that that kind of gives us an insight into how he thought and how he was teaching people. So one of the reasons anatta has a bad reputation is because people think it's a doctrine. And that's real easy to understand why it can be. People can think it's a doctrine. We kind of have a built-in need for doctrines. We're always looking to experts for pronouncements about how the world is, and especially from a Western perspective, we've got the philosophers. We're always looking for the ultimate way to explain everything. So Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." Right, and you got the physicists looking at string theory and quarks and trying, this is it. And you got the molecular biologists looking at DNA and says, this is the basis of life. So everybody's always looking for something that's authoritative. And people kind of expect the Buddha to be doing the same thing because he is an expert, right? So, I mean, what good's an expert without an expert opinion? Those of us that come from a Christian tradition or grew up knowing people with it, there's also this kind of this expectation. There's a doctrinal expectation. There are creeds in Christianity, and you say what you believe, and that's what you believe is part of being a Christian, right? It's the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed. Where I grew up, we said one of those every Sunday. That was part of saying what you believed was part of the worship service. And part of that is believing in a life after death. So, the Buddha's a great religious figure. Maybe he's got creeds too. Maybe there are things to believe to be a Buddhist. Maybe this no soul thing that we hear about, maybe that's part of something I need to believe in to be a Buddhist or something. And as part of this, we hear all kinds of stuff. The Buddha said, "We are all one." Well, he may have said that. Or the Buddha, maybe you hear the Buddha said, well, the Buddha said there's no soul, but there's no individual souls. There's really this big soul, and we're all kind of ripples in the big soul, so it's all kind of, we're all connected in a way, or something like that. And I'll tell you, I don't think that's what the Buddha was doing, but let's look at how that expectation came about, and then look at the suttas and see how he really taught. And I think there'll be something here we can take home tonight and use rather than get all confused about all this technical terminology, which is all too easy to do. So I think the first thing to do is let's look at anatta, where it comes from, the Pali roots for the word anatta, and see how it could have these different translations, because some people translate it as no soul, others as different, something else. So the first syllable is an, which is kind of a general Pali negation. It's kind of like un in English. And depending on the sounds following, sometimes it's just a. So akusala, arupa, anatta. So this is un-atta, whatever atta is. And atta meant variously as a pronoun like myself or yourself, a general purpose pronoun like that. And then with the if you had a capital A, It could mean like soul, and there was a in the especially in the Sanskrit version of this, Atman has a long history of being part of the kind of the individual expression of the cosmic soul that's deep inside of us, if I have that right. So when the translators saw the Anatta Lankana Sutta, they said, "Oh, wow! It must be a famous big doctrine about no soul," because in a way it kind of fits in with what some of the Buddha with what the Buddha said, but only if you don't read too much of the suttas. Only if you don't read too many of the scriptures do you have that idea. So far we have the idea that anatta means unatta, and there's the temptation to translate it as no soul, but let's look at the suttas here and see what he did. And, oh yeah, okay. And let's see if I'm skipping anything here. Okay, for that, I want to back up and tell the story of how the Buddha got to be a Buddha. And because all this is kind of relevant, allows me to tell a story. So the Buddha was born a prince, and some of the Brahmins that came to his kind of When the king first showed his son to his subjects, some of the Brahmins said, well, he's going to be either a universal monarch or an enlightened being, a Buddha. And one guy said, no, he's going to be a Buddha for sure. And his name was Kodanya. And so the father decided to keep his son kind of protected from everything in the outside world so that he wouldn't decide to go out and be a spiritual being. He wanted a son to be his heir. So the Buddha led a charmed life. He had his own palaces, one for the summer, one for the winter, and one for the rainy season. Never went anywhere, but where he could see what the world was like. But when he was 29, he saw in succession, he saw an old man, he saw somebody that was sick, and then he saw a wandering monk or ascetic. And the sick people and the old men, he hadn't seen this before. I don't know how he got to be 29 without seeing somebody that was sick or dying. But all of a sudden, this is a shock to him. Everybody around him was young. All of a sudden he woke up and says, wow, I'm going to be like this too. What's ahead for me? What do I want to be? And when he saw this wandering ascetic, or there are plenty of spiritual seekers just wandering around India at the time, he says, maybe that's the way. I want to find that. He could have gone to the Brahmins that were around his father's court. Brahmins were the upper caste in the Indian society, and the priests were part of that caste. And they were just kind of like this with the very tightly connected with the ruling class. So the Buddha would have had plenty of chances to see Brahmin priests and ask them questions and stuff. But that wasn't what he wanted to do. So one night he snuck off. It happens to be the night that his son was born, so doesn't get a lot of points for being taking care of his son. But he snuck off and went into the woods, and he was looking for teachers. And there were lots of different schools in India at the time, and a lot of them had variations on a theme that there was a soul that was inside, and it was covered up by the delusions of the mind or the impurities of the body, or it was just covered up by materiality. Anyway, the soul was in there. There was a soul. Some people called it Atman. It had to be released from the body or the mind. So the first thing he did was he went out and found one of the best meditation teachers in his part of India, and to learn how to master the mind. And he went with this teacher all the way up to the top of the teacher's capability. He went up seven levels in this ranking scheme of concentration practices. And the teacher said, "This is great. You want to be my co-teacher? I'll get, sit here with me, be my peer, teach my students." And he says, "No. He says this isn't doing it. I came to master the mind to find out true freedom." The guy said, "Well, there is one more step, but I don't teach it." So he went to the guy that did, and he mastered that. He mastered that eighth step. And at the end, he talked to his teachers. "Well, this is it." He said, "No, well, this is it. And the Buddha said, no, there's got to be more. So he left, respectfully left, and went and found he was going to do the other way of finding out, of trying to uncover the soul. And he disciplined his body. He became an ascetic, and he did some really, he's really hard on himself for about 6 years. He would go around living on moss and cow dung and dressing in animal hide and the tree bark or owl feathers, not taking a bath or even washing the dirt off his hair. He would eat like a grain of rice a day. You know, and there were times when there's at least one time when he was taken for dead or mistaken for dead, and or dying. And he said, no matter what anybody has tried in the past, what they may try today, or what they may try in the future, nobody can do better, can try harder than I have. They can equal me, but nobody can do better. And still, he hadn't found it. He didn't have this freedom that he wanted, this freedom from old age, sickness, and death. And this is a guy. I can kind of imagine him sitting there at 35 years old. He said, I walked away from this palace and this beautiful wife and this young son I haven't seen in 6 years, looking for enlightenment, and I haven't found it by mastering the body, and I haven't found it by mastering the mind. Is it possible? Maybe I can't do this. And while he was thinking this, he thought back to an incident that happened when he was a young prince, just 5 years old, something like that. His nurses left him alone for a while. And then they came back, and they were at a festival, and the nurses were, you know, kind of looking outside the tent, see all the colors and the pageantry and stuff like that. And young Gotama, Prince Gotama, was sitting inside. When they came back, he was sitting cross-legged, and he was in the first jhana. He was in meditation. The first jhana is the first of these eight steps. And he remembered back. He said, "You know, that was pretty good. It wasn't painful. I've been doing painful things for a long time. It was actually kind of nice. How about if I take what I know about the body and what I know about the mind? How about if I just sit down and apply both of those things?" So he sat down and he concentrated the mind and went through various. He found out various things during the first part of the night, and then in the last watch, you know, somewhere between like 2 o'clock and dawn, he was thinking about the body and thoughts and these things, not with any reference to trying to overcome them, but just looking at how they were. He knew what it was to suffer for the sake of suffering, hoping that he could, by enough suffering, he could unclog the pipelines and free the soul, or whatever particular doctrine he had. That night, this night, he was doing something different. He was just looking at suffering for what it is, for just trying to understand it for its, as it was. And by the time the morning star twinkled, he had it figured out. He was enlightened. He was the Buddha. Early in the night, he saw his past lives, and then later he got to figure out how he could look at somebody else and figure out what their lives were. But, you know, in the last watch of the night, he figured out what we now know as the Four Noble Truths and a few other things. So he decided, after he sat around for a few weeks, just kind of contemplating what he had done, what he had found out, he decided he was going to go and teach. He wasn't sure at first he was going to, because maybe nobody's going to understand this. But the way the suttas have it, they spice it up and one of the gods comes down and convinces them to teach. But that's still up to the Buddha to decide who should he teach. Who can understand this? So he could have gone back to his father's palace where all the Brahmins were, or he could have gone to find the greatest philosopher around. He didn't do that. He went and he said, who among the people that I know there are seekers could understand this? So he first thought of his two meditation teachers. They had died since he left him. And then he thought of the five ascetics who were with him, had been with him for most of the last 6 years. And he said, I think they'll know. They weren't with him because they thought the Buddha had gone soft when he accepted a solid food after 6 years of ascetic practices. So he went and he found his old students. His old spiritual friends. These guys were the closest people he had, his spiritual friends, and the people that he thought were most likely to understand this. So what he did was he picked practitioners. Sutta's kind of let us figure this out for ourselves. He didn't go to philosophers, okay? He went to people who had been looking and disciplining themselves, thinking that he had something that could turn the key for them. So he found them. And the first sermon he taught was the Four Noble Truths. And this is all leading up to Anatta. Okay. So first he taught how suffering, the first noble truth was taught about how suffering can appear in every corner of our lives, even when we're not looking for it or we don't expect it. It's easy to say that suffering is watching your parents die or being very sick. It's not so easy to say that suffering is finishing the beer after mowing the lawn and wishing you had another one. That's suffering too, right? Or suffering is having something very good happen and wishing you had more. All these little things we might not call suffering are suffering. And so the Buddha said the first noble truth was there is suffering. He didn't say that life is suffering. He said that suffering is what I'm dealing with. If life were suffering, then there'd be no way out in this life. And that's what he found. So life was suffering. And at the same time, he said that the suffering had to be understood. So that's kind of the part that we like to forget about the First Noble Truth, is that you have to understand suffering. And by that he means pay attention to it, and and not turn away from it. So if you're sitting and your knee hurts or something like that, you say, "Well, I'm sure I'd meditate better if my knee weren't hurting, so I'll move." Well, maybe the Buddha would say, "No, that's suffering. You need to don't hurt yourself, but understand the nature of that suffering." Sitting there with your knee hurting just to get it out is not understanding suffering. That's a suffering. The Buddha did that big time for 6 years, and he said, that's not the way. The key, the difference, was looking at the suffering and understanding it for what it was. Then the second noble truth is tracing all the suffering back to one source. And it wasn't being ununited with a cosmic being or anything like that. It was a craving or thirst, actually. The word the Buddha used was tana, which is thirst. I think that's an interesting word. You know, if you think back, I mean, thirst can mean a lot of things, right? It can mean standing in the hot sun and having your tongue stick to the roof of your mouth, and you really know you're thirsty. And thirst can also be just picking up a cup of coffee and setting it down before you even knew you did anything. So it's that whole spectrum. And all of it is thirst. The stuff that like the picking up the cup of coffee and putting it down, we might not recognize it, but it's there and it operates on this subtle level. And all of that, it's not just it's not this grade B and above suffering that the Buddha was about. He was after all of it. And that meant looking at all of the thirst, all of the craving. And then the third noble truth. Oh, and remember that only a few weeks before, he was wondering if enlightenment was possible at all. And there he might have been. And now he's saying, yes, it is. He's found the way. Then the third noble truth, he said, is that there is a way to do this. This isn't a thing that's given by grace, or that you have to be lucky, or only by birth, or whatever. There's a method. There's a way to achieve this. this enlightenment. And then the fourth noble truth is actually laid out the way, and that's called the Eightfold Path. And it's right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And I mention those because I want to talk about right view a little bit here too. When the Buddha says right view or right this or right in this context, it's not right in the sense of orthodox or correct. It's real easy for us to think that that's what right means. We're expecting orthodox, heterodox. I mean, we're expecting that kind of lineup. Sama, which is samaditti, right view, means like appropriate or thoroughgoing or effective, or something like that. It's when the Buddha is talking about right views about self or other things, it's not that there's a correct doctrine and a wrong doctrine that he's talking about. He's not saying, I'm going to tell you the, I'm spoiling my talk. You're supposed to figure this out in 20 minutes. But anyway, he says, this isn't about telling you what the correct doctrine is. This is about giving you the right tools to achieve this liberation. So all of the Buddha's thoughts about views were formulated around how effective they were in getting his teachings across, rather than about trying to teach you some cosmological truth. So after the first sermon, one of these five monks actually got a little bit of it. I think he got to stream enter. He saw his first glimpse of a liberation. And actually, that was the guy that we told you about when the Buddha was like 8 days old or whatever it was. One of the guys that says he's going to be a Buddha, that was the same guy, Kondanya. So he was with him, hanging out with him in the forest for 6 years. One of the guys that just walked off says, God, what a disappointment. This guy ate rice and bread. And anyway, here he is, one of the first guys to get the first taste. But it was only a taste, and it was only one out of the five. So in a few days, and this is the Buddha laid it all out here, the Four Noble Truths. That's the main stuff. He wasn't holding back. He wasn't saying this is just the warm up. There's better stuff coming. So what was going on? I mean, was it why weren't these guys enlightened? So then he gave his second teaching a few days later, which is the Anatta Lankana Sutta, the Sutta on the Anatta characteristics. So, well, we've got to ask ourselves, was the Buddha adding something to the teaching? I mean, was there something he said, oh, there's really a fifth noble truth, but I'm going to call it the Anatta Lankana Sutta? I mean, was there something missing? Was he adding something to the teaching, or was he taking something away that was an impediment to seeing the teaching? And I think it's, so let's see, let's just go on and where we just read the sutta here. He says, so the Buddha is in this game refuge, and he's talking to these five ascetics. He says, form monks, by that he means physical or material form. Form monks is not self. If form were the self, this form would not lend itself to disease, decay, unhappiness, unsatisfactoriness, whatever. It would be possible to say with regard to form, let this form be thus, let this form be not thus. But precisely because form is not self, form lends itself to disease. And it is not possible to say with regard to form, let this form be thus, let this form be not thus. So let me try and paraphrase this. He says, if form were self, I'd have more control over it. I can say, okay, my teeth aren't going to be loose this week, not at all, or time for the dysentery to stop, whatever. But he says, no, it doesn't work that way. He says, you can't do anything about it. Some things you can. If you're standing under the hot sun, you can move under the shade, etc. But you're not going to stop yourself from getting sick, from getting old, etc. So he says, form, and he says something that's that fickle, that's that that changes as much as this does, and is as unsatisfactory as this, that doesn't deserve to be called self, does it? He didn't say that there's no self. He just says, that doesn't deserve to be called self. Then later in the sutta, he says, and how do you conceive this, monks? Is material form permanent or impermanent? And they all say, impermanent, Lord. And he says, but is it fitting to regard what is impermanent, unpleasant, and subject to change as, this is me, this is mine, this is who I am? He says, no, Lord. So he's kind of leading the monks somewhere. Now, I think it was Socrates that had a dialogue with a slave boy or something like that, and by asking him a bunch of clever questions, proved that the slave boy had an intuitive understanding that the square root of 2 was an irrational number. Something like that. I mean, I don't know if it's Socrates. Somebody did that. Somebody did something like that. And you kind of get the idea that, I mean, that was a great trick, right? But you kind of got the idea that the slave boy wasn't any better for it. It was not like he was convinced or went home and felt, oh, wow, I really understood something today. I don't think the Buddha was trying to do that with the monks. He's not trying to trick these guys into believing something. I think he's trying to say, now let's look here. We're going to look at form right now, and we're just going to acknowledge, we're not going to say anything about, oh, I have to subdue this form. This form is standing in between me and the transcendental soul or something. We're just going to talk about what we can feel and what we experience. And he says that changes. It changes on its own. You can't do a whole lot about it. And a lot of the time, it's very unpleasant. Is that what you want to call soul, the highest goal? Well, no, I guess not. Then the Buddha, over the course of the sutta, does this with four other categories. He talks about perception, like seeing things, hearing things, or mental formations, and consciousness itself. And those five categories, the categories themselves aren't that important to us. I mean, here's where we choose that we're on the Anatta for Beginners track, and the advanced studies kind of veers off into the details. A lot of you know that this is the five khandhas, or aggregates, and those are fearsome things because they have all this philosophical baggage associated with them. And, later generations of commentators on the suttas, and they came up with, 50 different kinds of mental formations and 89 classes of consciousness. And I think there's 57 kinds of joy, 4 of which are unwholesome. I mean, it's lists upon lists upon lists. And then you can go off and say, well, I mean, you can really get off into the weeds here and not go anywhere. But if the Buddha wanted to talk like that, he would have found a philosopher. I mean, these guys, but he's talking with these guys who've been standing on one leg for weeks at a time, or standing in under the hot sun with fires on 4 sides of them. I mean, these are practical guys. He's pointing to the reality of their bodies and their minds and their thoughts as they know them. Sometimes the Buddha actually uses other categories. Sometimes he just uses a twofold partition, body and form, nama and rupa. Sometimes there's a whole section of the suttas the canon that treats things in a threefold partition. For us tonight in Anatta for Beginners, the classifications aren't important. What is important is what the Buddha was doing is he was, in a way that made sense to him and his audience, he was systematically going through all of anything we could know and saying, is it impermanent, is it satisfactory, etc. In fact, one of the word that the Buddha used at the time for what we translate as aggregates was really a fairly homey and folksy word. It meant like the back of a shoulder, not like a tree trunk, and like a heap. And he distinguished it by calling it the khandhas of clinging. But it was still a condo. It was still this very folksy term. And I think what he was trying to do was use words that were really familiar to people and that didn't have a lot of heavyweight spin or anything like that. Just trying to make, okay, we're talking about something we all know about here. So what kind of heaps was the Buddha talking about? Well, you can think, well, they're really collective nouns, like a team or a committee. Like there's a team, the 49ers. There is a team that's the 49ers, but if you look closely at it, there are 11 guys, but they're always coming and going, different people on the field at the same time. Maybe that's what he's talking about. And he said, well, gee, maybe that makes sense. You know, we know that the cells in the body turn over every 7 years or so, and there are people that think that the mind is really a bunch of small mini-minds, the society of mind theory, if you've ever heard of that, just doing things, and maybe that's what the Buddha was talking about. But that's not what we see when we actually look. If we look at, say, a knee that's hurting us or something like that, or the body, we'll tend, you know this from your own meditation, you'll be meditating, all of a sudden you'll shift and you'll notice a pain in the knee. At the time, if you look carefully, you're not thinking about your sit bones in the cushion or about your breath or about your head or anything else. You may switch very quickly between those. But it's at one time it's the pain in the knee. And it might not be the knee. It might be this thing floating in space that is alternately hot and cold or feels hard right now or feels prickly or something like that. When you look at it, the kind of the knee-ness disappears. You look closely enough at it, even your own ownership can kind of just, you know, it's like there's pain there, but it's somebody else's pain. You kind of disidentify with the pain. And that's, I think, what the Buddha was talking about. Heaps in that sentence, a sense of like a classification scheme, more like pigeonholes. These are names that, these are the only reality they have. I mean, there's only like one thing happening at a time. The only reality they have is the one that we impute to it by our ideas that that we're assuming. It's very conventional, it's just kind of baked into us. We think we have a body. I think it's interesting that the little kids have to learn that. They have to figure out that this toe they're sucking on is really part of them, and they kind of have to learn that they're a person and that they can move all these things together. And then we get to meditation here in the 40s or 50s, and we're trying to unlearn some of this stuff. So I think it was the second kind of heap that the Buddha was talking about. And I want to mention a few things about noting now. I mean, we're talking about the meditation. First, if we're looking at something, you can try and give it a transparent label. You know, like a little label you get in a store. It's clear. It just says, you know, CD, $17.99 or whatever. It doesn't block anything. It just kind of labels it. So if you're going to be labeling something or giving it a little name as it comes up, you can do that in the sense not to obscure it or to change its identity, but as a device to draw your attention to it and know when you're paying attention to something and when you're not. It's very helpful. I've trained with meditation teachers. You come in and they ask you to go through as many of the four foundations of mindfulness as you can. Gil's been talking about those. And say, what happened? Did you note it? And what happened then? And you'd be amazed. I mean, those are really hard questions. You get in there and you realize, no, I'm just kind of remembering what happened. And I'm trying to tell this teacher at the moment what was going on. But if you sit down with the intention of saying, I want to know what's going on as it goes on, and know about it in the most atomic terms, that kind of sharpens your practice. So instead of saying pain, you may say, no, that's a construct. You say, okay, no, it's hard, and it's hot, or it's cold, and it's moving, it's prickling, moving fast, whatever. That's the level at which the Buddha was asking the ascetics and asking us to look at it. You don't have to worry about if you're getting the perfect label and saying yes or again or this. That's okay. That's okay if it keeps you current with what's going on. Don't get stuck with being too discursive or worrying about the perfect label. Just the fact of being interested in what's going on is going to make the labeling easier for you and more appropriate. And the labels come easier and easier. Instead of, you know, a couple times a minute, it'll be every couple seconds, and then more and more. But you know, don't get hung up on it if you're not getting them that day. Just it's a tool to let you know when you're not doing it as well as anything else. And then this anything you can do to get your interest up, like paying attention, like this, like I said, paying attention to what happens. Do I label it, and what happens after that? If your interest is up, your energy is up, and it'll keep you from getting dopey and sleeping and drifting away. Okay, so when you do this, you don't need to use the five kinds. You can use the four foundations of mindfulness for your meal. That's why they're there, is for meditation practice. The idea isn't that we have the correct categories. The idea is to be naturalists, but not taxonomists. Okay, so if the taxonomy helps, that's fine. But mostly, we want to see what's going on. So if you look closely at that right knee pain, you'll see that things change, and sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And more importantly, the closer you look, the less it seems. You know, and you think if you look really closely, you're going to find out what that knee really is. The closer you look, the less it looks like there's a knee there. More it looks like little prickles moving around or something like that. You kind of get the idea that there's less there than meets the eye. And that's part of why we do the meditation. That's why the Buddha was calling the ascetics back to not what they expected to find or what they were going to find underneath, but just to look at the phenomena themselves. You can do the same thing with thoughts. I mean, you may find that if you just say, I'm sad, just sad, sad, that fact gives the sadness less power over you. I mean, you may find that you're still very sad about your father dying or whatever, but just knowing that you're sad and saying, oh, I'm sad, rather than have this, you know, be front and center and say, oh, the world is horrible, that can give you a little bit of freedom as well. So this is what the Buddha taught. This is what the Buddha taught us to do, and I think this is what he was talking about with the monks. So let's go back to the sutta. He says, how do you conceive this, monks? Is material form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. But is it fitting to regard what is permanent, unpleasant, and subject to change as this is me, this is mine, this is who I am? No, Lord. And I think this is the sutta's payload. He says, seeing thus, the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones grows disenchanted with the body, disenchanted with feeling, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with fabrications, disenchanted with consciousness. Disenchanted, he becomes fully dispassionate. Through dispassion, he is fully released. He discerns birth is ended, the holy life is fulfilled, the task is done. So I think it's a seeing for himself that the Buddha, that's what he wanted. When the monks, the ascetics had heard the four noble truths, if they were still looking at things in terms of this is me, this is mine, this is who I am, they weren't going to get it. I think what the Buddha needed to do, and what he did in the second sutta, was get him to look past that. He said, you know, if you can stop identifying with your thoughts, with your bodies, or with your feelings, then you can look at suffering for what it is. It's not something that's happening to you. It's not something you're doing so that you can be united with your soul. There's something going on that gets clouded by or is beyond our stories about it. So drop the stories and look directly at what's going on. And I think that's how the Buddha used anatta. It was at not as no self, but as not self. It was an admonition. It was a training tool for the monks. It wasn't something to be memorized or thought about. Those are more concepts, and they're just going to get in the way. We have plenty of concepts. The Buddha wanted us to drop those. So that is what I think how I think the Buddha used anatta. You may think that it's kind of splitting hairs to say that the Buddha never said that there was no soul, but people actually asked him. He says, well, is there a soul? Is there not a soul? It's got to be one of the two things. Or is there both a soul and not a soul, or neither a soul? He wouldn't go there. He basically some of the things that can happen with wrong views, even like there is no soul, Buddha wouldn't get into that. He said, if you have a doctrine and you disagree about it with somebody else, that's just getting in the way of your meditation. Even if you're right, it doesn't matter if you're right, the fact that you're contentious or whatever is getting in the way of your meditation. He says, if you have a belief and it's the wrong belief, it can lead you to, it can sabotage your practice. If you say there is no soul, then you say, well, there's no soul, then there's no rebirth, then there's no karma, then why should I practice? That was no good either. So the Buddha was not, it was really hard on people who tried to pin him into a box and say, well, is there a soul, or is there not a soul? What happens to the Buddha after his death? And the reason was, not that he didn't want to tell people, but because those weren't the things that were going to help him on their practice. And that's one of the things I like about this, about this practice, is that it's all so practical and so compassionate at once. It's not trying to come up with the greatest philosophy. We're just trying to come up with the best tools to get out from under old age, sickness, and death. So that's what I had to say about anatta for beginners. And are there questions, observations? I'd like to talk as just a group, you know. People may want to join in and answer one another, or whatever. We don't always get a chance to just to sit and talk like, you know, like this. So. You're all shy. I'll give you a few minutes and we'll sit if nothing happens.
The exercise of trying to go through and say, okay, I definitely believe that there is this me, and then saying, well, where is it? What is it? And sort of pressing the issue in a way that it doesn't exist is a very, very illuminating experience. Because what I found is that you cannot find the what it is. Mm-hmm. There is no thing. Unless you say it's the space in the middle of the form of everything else. I am exactly only that which is not me, and therefore I am infinitely small. It gets very difficult to go into with words, but you keep looking for it. It's not the body. It's not the body. It's not the bank account number. It's not the belief that you have. What is it?
Yeah.
And it's very interesting.
It keeps on trying to sneak back in, too.
But it's obviously true that I exist. There's absolutely, you know, if anything is true, you know, that I know for sure, of course, there's an I and know.
Right, right.
It's a very tricky, tricky thing. It's very surprising.
Yeah. I think the good thing is that we can see parts of it and then repeat that experience again and deepen it.
Well, it's also very liberating because if you really do come to the conclusion that this thing is a construct and is no more than a construct, then there is no need to be the locus of suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, have you ever run into trying to explain anatta, and, you know, just to somebody in a more casual way than this talk, and find out that there's a strong negative reaction to?
I don't have a specific memory, but I can believe that, as, you know, people. What are you talking about? Of course the Buddha said this, or of course the Buddha said we're all one, or the Buddha said this, and there's a people think they have all kinds of ideas about what the Buddha said. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, just more of, I'm thinking of an instance where I was talking with my wife and I said, you know, I don't think I exist. And that's a rather in-your-face way of putting it. And so we try to not put it in the in-your-face way, and that's probably why it was met with sort of a, or being taken aback in sort of a hostile reaction, because it implies, you know, that they don't exist. So perhaps I was just very unskillful in certain instances in trying to discuss the findings.
Yeah, you know, one of the things about the Buddha is he was this, one of the reasons he's so effective as a teacher is that he knew how to approach the issue with any given audience, you know, and I mean, with these ascetics who've been in the woods with him for years, he approached it another one way, and other people he'd approach it another. Like once he had one of his monks couldn't remember a two-line chant. And his brother, his older brother, said, oh, dumb brother, he can't remember no two-line chant. He wanted to get him kicked out of the order. He says, this guy's never going to make it as a monk. But the Buddha knew that this guy had spent a lot of work in a previous life working on defilements of the body or something like that. So he had this guy stand out in an open field with a white cloth in his hand, and just move it around in his hand, and he started getting sweaty and dirty and all that. The guy got enlightened, you know, because the Buddha picked the right thing. Then, of course, this guy went back, and his big brother had eat his words. But the Buddha was always, you know, could always pick what was appropriate and all that. And sometimes you just got to let it lie, you know. Sometimes you just got to let it lie too. Yeah. I don't know. It's a hard one. Oh, Lewis, I'm sorry.
I was just thinking about the kind of popular phrasing that goes, life hurts, everything changes, don't take it personally. And we don't take it personally, and it's sort of a different light than what we've been looking at. But I think that that's a very useful tool also. It's so easy to think that, you know, things are actually happening because we're here. To receive it, but you know, it's kind of a misguided point of view. And just to be able to feel like, oh, I'm not going to take this personally, makes a huge difference in terms of how one suffers in situations.
I'm thinking of my own reactions to that, you know, and well, yes, of course, that's right. How could I possibly disagree? And then I think, yeah, and I have to have boundaries too. You know, I have to, you know, I'm still trying to learn this Asian wisdom, and then I still have to learn, still have to get along with my my Western self here. And that's where I think some of the stuff gets really interesting, is where you take the teachings and you try and mix them in with, well, how do I take this off the cushion or into the office or whatever? And hey, that's when it gets really hard. I think. Well, we could sit for a few minutes until.
Yeah. Just in relationship to you talking about, I guess I never really think of another as my person not existing, and, you know, my physical person not existing, but have more to do with the ego or this mental construct of who we are. And one of the other Dharma teachers that had come said something. She had come back from Thailand and was kind of amazed that in the whole time she was there, no one really wanted to know her opinion. That whole idea of that you have an opinion, or that they cared about your opinion, or that you are, but that's where I saw a good part of myself, is that this attachment to what you think.
Right. The beliefs kind of might be the thing that we identify with most closely, but it's still clinging to something to identify with.
we have a tendency to attach the other as opposed to attaching to ourselves. It's very difficult to, for some reason, to attach to ourselves. We have to find, it seems, something we can physically see and be like another person, another thing, and attach to that. And all these concepts that we have been taught, I have been taught all my life, about how to do, how not to do, what to do, what not to do. It seems to all structure away from me, myself, my existence. And so we attach to something else and that looks nice. And you personalize into that, whether it's good or bad. An argument, a conflict, road rage, we personalize into it as opposed to, oh, gee, he was sad. Just leave it at that and become within ourselves or myself. I'm finding I'm learning this from being here and listening to wonderful teachers and therapists that I have, and a little bit of reading that I've been doing, workshops. I can find that I can be within myself, be present myself. And it amazes me that I would spend my time, a scenario, counting sheep at night. I would build this building, every little thing, every screw for the door, all the little pieces of wood, all night long. Maybe take a little nap, wake up, a little nap, wake up. And I still do that. I mean, I still don't sleep all night. But now I can be with myself and quiet of mind. And it's kind of amazing. I am me. I am alive. I am existing. I am great. Wonderful. And the concepts I have, but I can release them. I have a difficult time with it, but I can release them slowly. And the attachments I can also release. I'd like to know more.
Yeah.
I wish I could do it.
Yeah, well, quickly. Yeah, well, I think it's, I think the bad news is it's not something you can say you can agree with or and then do. That's why this is so. Why I took the Buddha to get us out of this. As we see, you know, it wasn't just a you know, you read a book or I mean those help. But and when it really gets tough, you know, the stuff you read in the book isn't going to do it. You know, it's. But I think it's the stuff you do in the pillow or practicing in life. I can do this, and I'm not quite so identified with it. I think it's the experiential angle of it. I mean, maybe this is just me. The experiential angle of it is what really takes it from me to make it real. And I may not know. I mean, like, it's common wisdom. You come back from a retreat and you don't know what you got. I mean, right? You know, it's like a... it'll show up in 6 months or a year, and you won't know it's from that retreat. It's it just kind of happens, and you know. But I think it's the like I said, the experiential angle.